Into the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Friday, September 20th, 2013, and this is podcast number 346. And my name is Ben Stone. Today, if you can hear it in my voice, I'm doing something I hardly ever have to deal with. I'm fighting a sinus cold, so if my voice sounds a little off, that's why. Yesterday, I recorded a conversation with my friend Davi Barker, and so here is that conversation with Davi Barker. And with me is my friend Davi Barker from, oh boy, from everything, from Shiny Badges, from Daily Anarchist, from what else, from everything. I mean, Davi is into everything.
Liberty, Bitcoin Not Bombs,
yeah.
Silver Circle Movie. Yeah, I get around the internet.
Thanks for coming back on the show with me. So what's going on right now? You've got a thing going on with hoodies. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, for those that don't know, one of the hats that I wear is the campaign navigator for Bitcoin Not Bombs. And what we do is we connect sort of we're still looking for a better term. We use the term nonprofit, but of course that's a tax status, and we don't really care about people's tax statuses. But essentially nonprofit clients or charitable clients, and we try to connect them with commercial clients in the Bitcoin economy so that when a charity decides to take Bitcoin, we can sort of run a fundraiser for them and then connect them with places that they can spend that Bitcoin without transferring back into dollars. You know, they call it closing the loop, right? So one of our commercial clients is a company called Mass Appeal Inc., which is a screen printer. And so they do t-shirts, but they also do all sorts of promotional products like pens and, you know, anything you can put your logo on. Well, Will Pangman over at Mass Appeal Inc. told us that he had 300 or so discontinued orange hoodies that were kind of on clearance. And so we started this, it's an all or nothing campaign on Bitcoin Starter, which is sort of like Kickstarter, where people can pledge money, but you don't actually get the money unless you meet your goal. So it's a simple project. There are 300 hoodies with no home, and we are trying to find homeless people to put them on. And so we're trying to raise 47 Bitcoin in all, which is actually, it's appreciated a little bit since we started. So we're probably going to throw in some socks or something like that. And it's just math. We're just asking people to go to Bitcoin Starter and to pledge some amount. If they don't want to register for Bitcoin Starter, they can go to bitcoin.bombs.com, and we're doing pre-sales for our next t-shirt, and the money is going to go to the hoodies, or any direct donation is going to go to the hoodies until the end of the campaign.
So now, as I understand this, a person can buy a t-shirt, and in the purchase of that t-shirt, also donate a hoodie, right?
Yeah, one t-shirt equals one hoodie. Yeah, they're priced so that one t-shirt, which is it's selling for $30 in free shipping, will cover the cost of both the t-shirt and the hoodie.
And then you guys will take care of distributing the hoodies to the homeless people, what, in the Bay Area there?
Yeah, San Francisco. I've been volunteering with a group called Project Feed in San Francisco that does bagged lunches once a month. And so we're going to work with them to get them distributed at one of the Project Feed events.
This is really good timing, too, because we're moving into autumn. And, you know, San Francisco is not known for its cold weather, but
California is not, but San Francisco is.
Well, people who have lived around San Francisco know that that winters in San Francisco are cold and wet. And it's not that cold air comes in off the coast and it just penetrates right to the bone.
Yeah, it does.
It's a little different than like Milwaukee or somewhere, but still, it's very cold. And this is a good time to be able to help out some of these people that are down on their luck and get a hoodie in their hands, but also advertising on them as well, right?
Yeah, this is sort of, I was originally calling it sort of the unspoken, like, side benefit or goal or whatever, but it's pretty spoken now. And it's that, I believe, and you know, Bitcoin Not Bombs, me and Drew both believe, and a lot of other people agree, that Bitcoin is an excellent tool to help homeless people. And that companies like Coinapool, there are a number of people developing wallet applications that will work on dumb phones. They call them dumb phones. That's like Nokia, like the old green screen Nokias, essentially text message-based Bitcoin transfers. So any phone that does text messaging can theoretically do Bitcoin. And so that has a lot of interesting implications for downtrodden people. And a lot of people are using this sort of to develop develop a Bitcoin economy in Africa. But there's no reason that it couldn't be used amongst the homeless population here. And some of the things that I think are an advantage of that is, first, it means that they can begin sort of earning and transferring money amongst themselves without the risk of being robbed. Because one of the reasons it's hard to get out of poverty, especially homelessness, is because you're at risk. You have no security. You're at risk of robbery all the time. But also it means that they would be accumulating a currency that appreciates over time instead of depreciates over time. Inflation causes a lot of poverty. So we think that if we were to essentially help people transition off of the dollar, even at the like lowest rungs of the population, that that they would essentially begin to be able to lift themselves out.
I think it's important that we kick some of the stereotyping about homeless people. I think it's important we kick that in the face too. You know,
I spend a summer being homeless. There are a lot of stereotypes that if anybody spent any time with them, they would find out they're not true.
Yeah, I was homeless with a house full of, not even a house, but with a truck and camper full of little kids, and we spent the better part of a year homeless, and it was not fun. But you know, it is possible to work yourself out of a situation if things just go right for you. But when you're in a situation like that, it's so easy for one thing after the next to go wrong. And you just get into a spiral you can't get out of. Homelessness is not always, it doesn't always mean the person is an alcoholic or a drug addict, or it doesn't mean they don't have a job, or it doesn't mean that they don't have money, or that they don't have, you know, a lot of homeless people are homeless because of a variety of circumstances that's unique to their situation.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I was voluntarily homeless, right? So I had kind of a nest egg of money, and I took a semester off of school, and I sort of wanted to sort of bum around, if that makes sense. And so I sort of experimented with street theater and panhandling and stuff like that. But I didn't need the money, so I always just gave the money right back out. And I like to tell the story of Larry Moore. Larry Moore is sort of a local celebrity in San Francisco. They call him the best dressed shoe shine man in the city. And he was homeless and he was an alcoholic. And then one day while dumpster diving, he found one of those old wooden shoe shine stands, right? And he went into business for himself. He bought himself a sort of old suit from a thrift store and sort of started selling like old fashioned shoe shines. And he made a bunch of money, and he had this goal of, I think he needed $5,000 to get off the street. And as soon as the Chronicle covered his story of his sort of like ambition, it was this great sort of start him up and like rags to riches, whatever kind of story, the state came after him and they told him that he owed them $5,000 for a street vending permit. So like when I talk about robbery, I don't just mean other civilians. I do mean the state. It would be difficult for the state to come in and take Roger Moore or Larry Moore's money if his money was in Bitcoin.
That is amazing. Oftentimes it is the authorities that are the worst, literally the worst enemy of the homeless people. We've seen this in Miami and Detroit. We've seen it in Dallas, where, you know, the authorities actually come in and stop the voluntary organizations that are there to help them, whether they're distributing water, distributing food, distributing clothes, and they come in and shut them down and won't let them do it because they don't have some obscure permit to help people.
Yeah, you know, to their credit, Project Feed has never asked for permission to distribute this food. And as far as I know, it actually is illegal to do that without a permit, you know, on health grounds or whatever. I'm interested. I'm appreciative that no problem. They've never run into any problem. But as far as I know, there's no regulations anywhere preventing somebody from passing out clothing. But who knows? I mean, they change the rules all the time.
Yeah, if the city figures out a way they can get a cut, they're going to try.
Yeah, that's really, it's not really about health regulations.
So what else you got going on? I know you wrote a really good article over at Daily Anarchist just the other day. I was reading that.
Is that the Million Market, Million Man Market?
Yeah, the idea is, look, there's always somebody going to Washington, D.C. to protest about something, right? And yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be a million people, but if a large group of people are going to be in Washington, D.C. protesting about something, hey, let's sell them stuff.
Let's go out there and sell our lemonade and our raw milk and our buttons and our T-shirts. Yeah, absolutely. Because we have seen that kind of activism of going to Washington, D.C. to sell lemonade, right? And they all got arrested for selling lemonade. But they just did it on a normal day in the park, right? But if you did it during – if you sort of co-opted or crashed one of these other marches – then first off, you know there's going to be a huge customer base, which means it's more likely to be profitable for the market activist. But it also means that you're hitching your ride on the civil disobedience of it. You're saying, we're not just going to go to Washington and like yell at them. We're going to go to Washington and show them how sort of elegantly we can live without them. And I think that it is a more powerful demonstration than holding a sign and yelling, because I don't think holding a sign and yelling accomplishes anything anymore.
Not in 2013, but in 2012 at the raw milk protest in Washington, D.C., by chance, it wasn't planned, there was some type of a women's rights activism type organization going on at the exact same time as the milk freedom people were doing their activism. And it created a situation where there was, and they were on opposite sides of the park from each other, and it created a situation where the local D.C. police, who have a tendency to come down on the raw milk people and the lemonade people, they just stayed away because there was already plenty for them to deal with the women's rights people, and they couldn't allow themselves to get caught up doing, you know, 15 hours of paperwork over some raw milk when there's a much bigger protest going on the other side of the park.
Oh yeah, that too. It's cloaking, it's camouflage, right?
Yeah. And actually it fits my, you know, my I wouldn't say that my series on Beyond Civil Disobedience, I wouldn't say that's against civil disobedience, but in that series I talked about how civil disobedience really is just asking the government to do what you want it to do. But this wouldn't, what you're describing is not that. What you're describing is going in and essentially capitalizing on the audience that's already there while still getting across your point.
Right. Here's the thing is it could really be either, because what makes a thing civil disobedience is breaking the law publicly. So some activists may go in and that might be their shtick, and they might set up a table and say, you know, we're selling this stuff illegally and we're doing it in conjunction with the rally. But what makes it agorism is doing it covertly. So that could be another group of activists simultaneously going in and selling things kind of covertly to the same rally. So it really, it fits either description. But either way, it's outreach to the people who are there protesting, because while you're selling them stuff, you could be handing things out, you could be starting conversations, you could be networking and meeting new people, and you could be explaining to them why counter economic activity is more powerful than sine waving.
I think that's really, really brilliant. I was reading that article just almost giggling as I went through it.
Well, yeah, I mean, now I just have to do it. I mean, I got the idea from the Million American March Against Fear that was scheduled for 9/11. And unfortunately, I had the idea just a little bit too late to organize anything, right? But, there will always be another Million Man March somewhere down the road, right? Like, we can count on people being upset with Washington.
Yeah, that's a pretty much guaranteed thing.
Ernest Hancock from Declare Your Independence has proposed Black Friday, and he's calling it Black Market Friday, and he's essentially asking for people to sort of engage in counter economic sales or use counter currencies or essentially sort of capitalize on that day as a demonstration that we don't need the dollar.
Any particular Friday or just every Friday?
Oh yeah, Black Friday is a specific day. It's the day after Thanksgiving. It's the biggest shopping day of the year, right?
Ah, okay.
So he's rebranding Black Friday, Black Market Friday.
Yeah, that would be great opportunity for people, especially if you had some way to get like a bunch of knockoff, not to deceive people with, but to sell knockoff stuff that's, you know, outside of the Nordstrom's or outside of the whatever. Might be a little bit dangerous, but
you know what I've always thought would be a really good product if you were going to do sort of knockoffs, and you wouldn't claim that this was authentic. You're not deceiving people, you're just breaking IP laws. But if you've probably seen this, that people will go to concerts and they'll buy one of the sort of tour shirts, and then they will print knockoffs of the tour shirts and sell them out in front of the concert, right?
Right.
And concert halls have gotten smart to this, and their security guards are sort of briefed on how to spot these people and how to shut them down. And so you can't really sell knockoff rock concert shirts anymore. But theaters haven't. So every time a new Avengers movie comes out or a new Spider-Man movie comes out or a new X-Men movie comes out, there's nothing preventing somebody from driving from theater to theater selling bootleg comic book shirts out of the back of a truck.
Yeah, and I remember in the olden days there would be a guy actually in the concert, and he would have like bundles under his jacket, bundles of shirts, and he would just walk around through the people in the concert selling the t-shirts until the guards would throw him out.
Yeah, but the security guards for theaters are not smart to this yet.
Right.
That's my point. Plus, those guards are not looking for that guy.
Plus, everybody in the theater comes dumping out at the same time as each movie is over.
Or lined up. If it's a popular enough movie, they'll line up waiting to buy tickets.
Yeah, that is the perfect time to just casually walk down the row with your jacket stuffed full of t-shirts, you know, rolled up t-shirts. And that's a great idea.
And then, you know, you make it activism by, like, let's say, I mean, we miss Tolkien, right? But let's say that the Tolkien movies were just coming out and we knew that there were going to be, you know, hordes of orcs lined up outside of the theater, right? So you could make a bootleg Tolkien t-shirt, and with it, either include a sort of like rebellious slogan on the shirt, or even better, include a brochure explaining that Tolkien was an anarchist and include it in the sale of every shirt, right?
Yeah, and maybe even add to whatever bootleg imagery and whatever that you put on the shirt, like on the back or something or on the pocket area or whatever, put that quote with Tolkien explaining to his son why he's an anarchist.
Sure. So this is we're actually going to do this with the hoodies. I mean, we're not selling the hoodies, but we are going to make an informative brochure to hand out with every hoodie to explain how a person can get a Bitcoin wallet on a text-based phone and sort of what the advantages of Bitcoin might be to the homeless community. But, I mean, this would work if you just had enough lead time on any movie that was coming out to figure out what the Liberty themes were going to be ahead of time. You could totally do this at a theater.
Yeah, this is one of the things I like to talk to you about, Dovey, because, you know, we did this at Porkfest. It's like as soon as we start talking, these things start popping up. Like, all, my mind just starts rolling through all kinds of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much the same. You mentioned Ernie a minute ago. You can watch Ernie do that, too. As you talk to Ernie, it's like his mind just lights up and he starts thinking in every kind of direction.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really like about his show, and your show, too, is that it never ends where it started.
Yeah, there's some intentional misdirection there to a certain extent, but a lot of it is just, the result of brain damage. So now,
but okay. I like these ideas. Like, the whole Beyond Civil Disobedience series really appealed to me because it was such outside the box thinking. Like one of the things that one of the criticisms that I get if I come out as not being a voter is people say, oh, well, then you're not doing anything, right?
Right.
Like, voting is the very minimum that you can do, and if you're not doing that, then you're not doing anything. But that was not my experience at all. Like, deciding not to vote was not an experience of apathy for me. When I consciously made the decision that I wasn't going to do that, like, suddenly this sort of, like, I felt this, like you could, it's like a weird, it's such a strange emotion. It's like a combination of a burden and freedom at the same time. To do something else, to find something more effective. Now that I had, like, released my resources from trying to figure out who to vote for in this weird horse race, all of those resources were sort of, those mental resources were devoted to thinking of something else to do. And I think that that's the power of the Beyond Civil Disobedience meme, is that if you say to a person, well, you can't, like, stop waving signs, stop voting, stop engaging in these things we know won't work, what do you come up with next?
Right.
And those things are always much more exciting. And the fact that they're exciting and they're new and they're fresh, I think inspires people to try them. Like, people want to try things that haven't been tried yet because they want to find something that works.
You know, up in Keene, New Hampshire, they have that the Robin Hood of Keene, where they go and put change in parking meters.
Yeah, you know, that's illegal in California.
I think it's illegal in a lot of places. But in doing that, in a sense, it's civil disobedience. In another way, it's outreach. But in another way, it's kind of a street theater. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about that you have done street theater. You've told me about some of the different things that you've done in street theater. And in a way, I think you can get a whole lot more positive attention by doing something really unexpected and maybe goofy, but that's mm-hmm. not necessarily, Washington is the problem, let's go get Washington type mentality. It's right here, this is in our town, and there's a guy walking on his hands with, you know, something on his feet, or what, I'm just, you know, just making things up. Whatever goofy thing it is that's happening, people will think about that far more than a story where, oh yeah, there's somebody protesting in Washington, or, you know, there's somebody handcuffing themselves to the police station, or whatever.
Something. Well, it's like all the sort of creative ways that people covered up traffic light cameras.
Yeah, exactly.
The guy around his Santa Claus and put a big Christmas box over it, or there were people that tied balloons in front of it so that the camera would just pick up pictures of balloons, or all sorts of things. The bunny. Yeah. So that does two things, right? That first off, it immediately connects the people who are upset about the cameras. They suddenly immediately realize, oh, there are other people in the population who are as upset about this as me. Right. Which maybe they were silent about it. Also, it is funny. It lightens somebody's day. They get a smile out of it. Right. And also it shows them where the cameras are, because a lot of times people are driving and they're kind of in autopilot mode and they don't even notice the cameras when they go up.
Yeah, that's true. That brings a level of awareness that a lot of people might not have gotten otherwise.
I think probably the smile on their day is the most powerful, because that's part of the Robin Hood thing too. Like, it must feel so great to, like, think you've got this ticket on your windshield and then look at it and then, oh no, actually it's the opposite of a ticket.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, A lot of the stuff that activists are doing all over, I don't want to condemn what anybody's doing, but I really think that we have this tendency to want to copy other people, when in reality, you know, our own ideas, sometimes if you just put your mind to it, you can come up with really, really good ideas on your own. It's just a matter of, you know, having that one little extra bit to say, yeah, I'm going to do this. And calling up a friend and saying, look, this sounds like a crazy idea. Dress like a rabbit, put up a fake egg over a traffic camera. Or this sounds like a goofy idea to take a bucket of change around and fill parking meters. But having that extra little push to say, all right, let's do it Saturday. Let's just do it. I mean, that's really, that's what we need.
I've definitely noticed in all of the more theatrical activism that I've done that having a partner is incredibly valuable. One of my best friends is a guy named Andy Christ, if you can believe that. And we discovered when we were doing street activism that it always worked best if we had a speaking character and a silent character. Yeah. So that while one person was the speaker, the barker, the other person was sort of the assistant, and then we would switch off because your voice would get hoarse or whatever. But also that means that one person is a spectacle. They're like a billboard. They're like in a funny costume or they're holding a funny sign or whatever. And then you have the second person is the one that the attention is being directed toward, and they're there to speak, to answer questions, to do the theatrical portion. And that I'd never thought of it before. This was in 2003, but when I read your when I heard your series on civil disobedience or beyond civil disobedience, it occurred to me that that is a two-man con. Like, that's a grifter strategy, right?
Right.
But it totally works.
Actually, that goes all the way back to vaudeville and before. That was a standard thing to have your straight man and your comedy man, and the straight man's doing all the talking, and the victim, so to speak, is the one getting the pie in the face or getting hit with the rubber baseball bat or, you know, whatever's going on. It's the Penn and Teller type thing taken.
It's totally Penn and Teller, absolutely. And it would be the same with any of these actions. Like, if you were to try and sell T-shirts, you need the guy holding the T-shirts under his shirt and selling them, but you also need the guy holding the inventory in the truck and restocking.
Yeah.
Right? It's like there's always a public and a private persona, which is almost the same as your Lego underground and your above ground activism, that is a two-man con.
It really is. I wasn't sure if I was getting that across correctly. You know, I hate to bring this topic up because there's been so much anger of late, and I think so many people misunderstood each other, and there was so much confusion. But in the thing between Cantwell and the Free State Project, with all the good and all the bad mistakes and everything that was made in the middle of that, you have to have, if you're going to have two different groups with the same goal but vastly different methods of getting to that goal, they have to be, as far as the public knows, separate. You can't have one calling out the other and then the other, you know, recalling out that one. You destroy the whole purpose of what we're doing. You have to have the one doing its thing and the other winking quietly in the background. Or,
you know, this is another reason people think rallies work. Because, like, if you think about, I was thinking about this as far as school is concerned. When I was in school, we had, Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And there was a whole unit on studying Martin Luther King Jr. and his activism and why he was successful, right? But this was not real history. This was teaching a sort of whitewashed version of Martin Luther King. Because Martin Luther King, like, worked closely with Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely the sort of the peaceful group and the violent group, right? Like, Malcolm X was very publicly in favor of self-defense against bureaucrats. And by not teaching that half of the coin, public school teaches kids that passive sort of ineffective activism was what changed the world. And it wasn't.
Yeah, it's the yin and the yang. It's the two sides of the thing seemingly going against each other, but in fact accomplishing the same goal.
Yeah, well, I'm not denigrating Martin Luther King at all. I'm saying that he is being misconstrued in history classes.
Right.
And I'm willing to bet you'd find the same phenomenon with Gandhi, and I'm willing to bet you would find the same phenomenon with any of these things where they sort of teach us the history as they want us to repeat it.
Yeah, I would be willing to bet that, because we're talking about principles here. We're not talking about you know, what we've necessarily, the story that we've been told, but you can look something.
It's a quote from Gandhi that one of the greatest crimes of the British Empire against India was disarming them.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like pacifism to me.
Yeah, if they were truly pacifists, it wouldn't have harmed to disarm them. That's perfectly fine. They weren't using their guns to defend themselves anyway. But right. The story doesn't make sense that way.
Right. The first time that I listened to your series, I've listened to it a few times now. The natural above ground, underground split that occurred to me was left anarchists and right anarchists. Hmm. And I felt like left anarchists they're much more sort of violent ideologically, or in practice, they're much more willing to throw rocks or break windows or things like that. And they have less ties to family and property. Like that was one of your criterion,
right,
for the LEGO Underground, was that they couldn't be hindered by levers the state could use to intimidate them. And that's definitely true of left anarchists who are living in these punk houses or living in these communes or living on the street. But I don't know any way to like reach out to them and convince them that this kind of a marriage is appropriate, because they just hate capitalists so much. Like, they would not cooperate with property rights respecting anarchists in any way. And I've had them like scream in my face that I don't exist. This was during Occupy San Francisco, and I was hanging out after hours. It was all anarchists. The like regular activists would go home, and the people holding the ground at night were all of the sort of more radical elements, but they were all Marxists. And so I said, I'm right there with you. You know, I lean sort of more toward the, anarcho-capitalist side of things, but you know, if you want to share your property, that's your right. And this woman like screamed in my face that I didn't exist and then ran away.
Oh, that's interesting though. Not long ago, I was up in Michigan, and some of the people working with the Detroit stuff that's going on were sharing their stories and what was going on there. And Detroit, in a very weird way, is very much like San Francisco in the sense that it's becoming a collection point for left art anarchists, and it's a place that they can go. There's abandoned property. They can take things over. They can start doing stuff because the city government is so inept, and they're so backwards, you know, from being such a bloated bureaucracy, that you can do almost anything and they just can't do anything about it. And so there are, I guess we would call them right-leaning anarchists, but I think ANCAPs is a better description, that are going in there and are also trying to have an impact and trying to do their thing. And that might be a very interesting way of thinking of it, because there is this thing in the typical anarchist's mind, in the typical ANCAP mind, that has this obsession with respecting property, that in many ways, when you're dealing with government property and abandoned property, and even, I hate to say it, but even corporate property, it's not necessary to respect them according to ANCAP standards. But yeah. ANCAPs have a tendency to be obsessed with respecting property.
Right, but it has to do with how the property was acquired.
Right.
Right? Like, I have an interesting kind of moral dilemma, if you'll hear this. I've written a zombie novel, and I'm expecting it to come out by Christmas, and I have a book deal for 3 books, right? And so it'll be a trilogy and hopefully an ongoing series, and the publisher would not agree to leave it in the Creative Commons. He insisted that it be copyrighted.
Okay.
But I hold the copyright, which is all just bizarre, right? So like he tells me if we're going to dispute somebody who's violated the intellectual property of the novel, I will have to be on board with that, which of course I will never be. So what is the point of copyrighting? But his argument was that he like philosophically even agreed with me, but his argument was that if one of these large firms like Disney or something decided that they liked the story and it wasn't copyrighted, they would just take it and make a movie or a series out of it and leave me out of it entirely.
Right.
And they had the money to do that. Like they had the money to completely leave me out of it. Whereas if it were a smaller firm, then the reputation of screwing over the author would be enough incentive not to do it. And that is what do I want to call it? Like libpair, as Michael Dean says, right?
Right.
That would be the mechanism. The mechanism is that a firm would not make a movie without the author because the audience would know better. But if Disney were to do that in the world that we live in today, I don't have a loud enough microphone, right? Unless I sue them, like a lawsuit might get headlines. But so the reasoning that I kind of almost agreed with, and I just don't know how to get around it, is Disney's wealth is ill-gotten gains. They have gotten to be the large firm that they are by exploiting intellectual property rights laws.
Right.
So the fact that they are a large enough firm to bowl over a small author is because they have sort of implicitly agreed to these rules already.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to behave about that.
Yeah, I think it's more of a self-defense thing against somebody like that. And you know, this is, without fleshing it out too far, using things like existing laws, property right or other, but using existing laws and so forth, in a sense we can say, well, I don't want to do that, but we could also make that argument with the roads. Well, you know, the roads are aggression. They steal from people who may never drive on the roads, and then they build the roads with them. But we don't avoid the roads. I mean, we still use the roads. It's not...
I avoid the roads. I don't have a car. I bicycle full time.
Oh. I forgot. Yeah, those people in San Francisco bicycle everywhere.
I guess that's still using the roads, but I mean, I avoid the DMV.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Rebel. Yeah, but
I would never think to use intellectual property rights to attack someone for using the image of the book or using an excerpt of the book or using the character of the book or whatever. But if Disney came in and wanted to make it into a movie and leave me out of it,
yeah, they're free
game. I don't know. Like, I would be in a very uncomfortable position, right?
Yeah, I would feel comfortable taking a whack at them. Not just because they're big, but because, like you said, they exist through aggression, and they really do. You know, Disney exists because, and that's kind of an argument against what we believe in and teach, that well, there wouldn't be any, there wouldn't be a giant McDonald's, or there wouldn't be a giant Walmart, or there wouldn't be a Disney or a General Electric in a libpair world. Because no corporation could ever get that big. And yeah, that's probably true. And so we might have to pay, 75 cents extra for a hamburger or $100 extra for a giant flat screen TV. But we also wouldn't have, 60, 70% of our income taken from the government to go build roads where nobody drives on them.
Yeah. I think there might be large firms. Like if you look at the history of the tech boom, IBM and Apple were initially sort of, and they're still very large, but they were initially a sort of market monopoly practically, but it was because they were first to market. It wasn't really until intellectual property got involved, they were dominant firms in the tech industry because of their innovation. But that eclipses very quickly. So like the person who, invents the new mousetrap is going to have a monopoly on that mousetrap until somebody reverse engineers it, right?
Yeah.
But actually get very big and wealthy in the process.
I suppose Bayer aspirin could be an example of that, because when in the 1800s, when they started, they were, you know, in different countries selling a product that pretty much everybody else could also sell at the same time. But because of their reputation of purity, and again, we're talking 1800s, not necessarily today, but because of their reputation of purity and honesty, that company was, you know, as more successful than Goody's or whoever else that was selling the identical product.
Yeah, but people, big companies collapse just as quickly if they're subject to free market pressures.
That's true. Folks, there's only a finite supply of gold and silver in the world. However, politicians can print paper on a whim forever and ever. Hedge yourself against inflation and a volatile stock market by purchasing gold and silver bullion from Amagai Metals. As inflation gets worse, it will become more difficult to buy gold and silver. So secure your financial freedom today by visiting AmagaiMetals.com. That's AmagaiMetals.com. Or you can give them a call at 1-800-882-8496. That's 1-800-882-8496, where financial freedom is yours. And be sure and tell them BadQuaker.com sent you.
Energy, vitality, clarity of mind, and incredible immune support. The awesome power of nature is now in your hands. Hi, this is Sean from One with Nature. Our herbal formulas contain some of the greatest botanicals from around the world, and they are ready and willing to help you achieve your goals. Visit us at onewithnature.com. That's W-O-N with nature.com.
Okay, so we hit the hoodies. We hit. Did we talk about Bitcoin's not bombs?
Just in general?
Yeah.
Sure. Well, I mean, I give you the kind of introductory spiel. We're a platform for our commercial clients and our charitable clients to kind of meet each other, and we run donation drives for new charitable organizations to the Bitcoin economy. We're also we're trying to internationalize the logo to some extent. I don't know if you've come across, I'm sure you've seen the Bomber logo, right?
Right, on my t-shirt.
So that's what we're going to be putting on the t-shirts and on the hoodies. But we also have some folks in Tokyo and some folks in the UK who are going to be printing the t-shirts completely independently of us. So I just sent them the vector art, and they're going to print them and sell them independently. And we're kind of trying to turn the logo not into necessarily a logo of our organization, but just the logo of this this belief that Bitcoin is a sort of an anti-war currency, right? Like, in the same way that Food Not Bombs is not a sort of centralized hierarchical organization, it's lots of decentralized chapters. We're sort of trying to encourage the idea that other people can start up local chapters of Bitcoin Not Bombs as a sort of charitable group and use this logo, you know, however they want to sort of say that they don't want the war dollar. They want a free economy.
I hope it catches on, because it's a really cool logo with the B-17 and the Bitcoins falling out of it.
Yeah.
Also, I wanted to ask you if this is not really a this is kind of a side issue, but did you see the, their name escapes me, the two uber rich Bitcoin brothers who,
I always want to call them the Wachowski brothers, but those are the guys that did the Matrix. It's the two guys not from Facebook, but, you know, related to Facebook, right?
Yeah, they sued Facebook and got a bunch of money.
I can't remember their names either. It begins with a W, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a complicated name for a person like me who has a hard time pronouncing words anyway. But there was a news, I'm stumbling because I can't remember what the news story was that just came out like in the last 24 hours that they were going to make an effort to try to get Bitcoin more in the mainstream. Not just, I know they were working pro-government regulation of it, But there was something that they were doing outside of that effort to try to make it more.
Oh, they're trying to open a brokerage firm, essentially.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get it recognized as like a real financial institution, right?
That may have been what I was thinking. I'm kind of stumbling here as I Google.
I wrote an article a few months ago called "The Problem with Bitcoin is Dollars," and the reason is because it's the Winklevoss twins. There's the name.
There you go. Okay, so there you go.
The problem is that Bitcoin is incredibly like resilient and efficient independently. And if you stay in the Bitcoin economy and you transfer Bitcoins around and you find ways to both like spend them and earn them, then you don't really have a lot of run-ins with the state. But the moment that you try to cash out with dollars and you try to exchange them with dollars, they imagine that that means that all of their regulations attach. And so now you are, you know, a currency emitter, or you're a financial firm, or you're like all this sort of legal jargon attaches to what you're trying to do if you touch the dollar. But if you don't touch the dollar, then there's no real way to attach any of that stuff.
And that situation improves with more and more people taking Bitcoin, and you can directly exchange it rather than having to go through a third party. The more of that takes place, the less you need the dollar anyway.
Yeah, that's the goal of a lot of us, yeah. I've been trying to popularize the term Quisling. I'm sure you've come – this is like an old World War II term, but people haven't really – it's sort of fallen out of favor, so I'm trying to co-opt it. And I would like to use the word Quisling for Bitcoiners that beg for regulations.
That was I was trying to – it sticks in my mind that I know what that meant back in World War II. Was it like a collaborator with the Nazis or something?
Yeah, it was a parliamentarian from Norway who was essentially a traitor to Norway and joined Hitler as some kind of consultant, or I don't know. But yeah, he was essentially a traitor and a collaborator with German fascism.
Yeah. Hey, I wanted to jump backwards for a second to your zombie novel and tell the listeners just a quick little story. When we were at Porkfest, and there was one of the seasonal campers that is camping there at Rogers Campground, and it's an elderly lady. She had a nice fifth wheel, and she's pretty much there for the season, you know, just spending the evenings and just relaxing in the great atmosphere and everything. And she was camped what would be that, just slightly north or northwest of us. I was north of you, and she was north of me, so it was just like right up the aisle of where you were and right up the aisle of where I was. And I think it was about the last day that you were there or something, she overheard us talking about your zombie novel, and she just, from her camper, she kind of like shouted down, "Oh, I like
it." I remember this woman. Yeah. She was sitting on her little porch, and I went and gave her a copy, all right?
Yeah, how strange for this elderly woman in a campground to be a zombie science fiction fan, and for you to be there just at that right moment to hand her something that she would be interested in like that. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. I'm really excited. I think I've cracked the zombie genre, and you know, I try not to be too arrogant about it, but I really think that I have. Essentially, I've taken your concept of the separation of the government and the state, that these are two concepts, and I have crafted my virus on that idea. And what I mean by that is, essentially, I've designed zombies to be a symbiotic relationship between a protein infection, which is like mad cow disease, and a parasite that infects the brain. So the protein infection is the government. It causes the physical changes in the body that make the zombie dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the parasite is the state. It is nothing except the psychological changes that affect a zombie, right? Hmm. And so the person doesn't become dangerous until they have both of these infections, and the transformation isn't triggered until they have both of these infections. And if you don't have or are for some reason immune to the parasite, then the protein infection has no effect on you.
Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say that's kind of, you know, I was thinking about some of the research that you've done on authority and some of the other in telling some of the research that has been done. A recent article you had again over at the Daily Anarchist, this was back about a month ago or so, you were talking about how some of the research shows that the actual psychology or physiology of people changes once they perceive that they are an authority. Once they believe the line that they're an authority, they think differently.
Yeah, absolutely. And it happens very quickly.
That's kind of like that infection taking place.
Right. So it actually plays right into my the immunity of the virus. If you've come across Stefan Molyneux's Bomb in the Brain series, he talks about they're called ACEs or adverse childhood experiences. And the more adverse childhood experiences that a person has, the more physiological changes that you can see in the brain. And this specifically affects the amygdala, which is sort of the aggression centers of the brain, right?
Yeah.
So the people in my story who are immune are the ones who don't have that brain damage, because that brain damage in the amygdala is where the parasite sets up shop. So if you have a healthy brain, if you have a non-aggressive brain, then the parasite has nowhere to set up shop. So, yeah, essentially, the zombie virus is an extension of authoritarian sociopathy. And the more of a sociopath or the more of an aggressor you are as a human being, the more higher functioning of a zombie that you end up being in the story. So this sort of solves the problem in a lot of zombie stories where, like, there are some zombies that sort of walk slowly and moan, and there are other zombies that sort of run, and there are zombies that say brains and zombies that don't, and zombies that use tools and zombies that don't. And fans are always upset that they're not consistent. And so I've sort of devised my virus to explain why they aren't consistent. And the reason is because authoritarian sociopaths are better zombies.
And there's so much truth to that. Even though we're dealing with fiction, there is so much truth to
right,
it that it just rings true.
I really think I've cracked the metaphor of the zombie. Like, the zombie has been searching for a metaphor for a long time, and I think I've done it.
It's like when whoever it was that figured it out figured out that there's a connection between the mythology around vampires and sexual attraction. And once they figured that out and started writing the stories with that included, the genre exploded.
Blows up into a genre.
Yeah.
And it's the same with werewolves. Like, werewolves were originally folklore about, you know, scary stuff in the woods. But once they realized that it was a metaphor about human rage, suddenly it becomes a genre, and you have human characters who are werewolves and struggle with, you know, Teen Wolf is possible because of that.
Right.
The Incredible Hulk is possible because of that, right?
Right.
I'm essentially casting the zombie as a metaphor for man's struggling with the desire to dominate other men.
This could really be big.
I hope so. I mean, I've got a 3-book deal already, so it's something.
Well, I know you have another show to do today. You were going to be on
I'm going to be on Pork Therapy at noon, yeah.
Oh, that's right, Pork Therapy.
That's Stephanie Murphy. She is my virologist in the zombie story. I have Dr. Murphy from Free Aid is the sort of free market virologist who figures out the virus. Because the CDC just, you know, they're incompetent.
Stephanie's a lot of fun to talk to anyway. She's a really neat person. She was up at the Michigan Peace and Liberty Festival not long ago, and I didn't really get to spend very much time with her, but it was neat to see her there, and she and her party had come all the way from New Hampshire to be there. That was really pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's probably one of my favorite people. I've been listening to her show probably since the beginning. I definitely went back and listened to the whole show.
Before I let you go, you're also going to be in at Libertopia, right?
Libertopia was a month ago. I think the next one is Freedom Summit in Phoenix.
I was thinking it was in October.
Is there something in October?
Maybe, go ahead.
What are you thinking?
No, I was confusing Libertopia with a Bitcoin thing that's happening in Alabama in October. Totally unrelated. Oh,
yeah. I'm not planning on going to that. Yeah, I went to Libertopia to talk about the Renegade Psychological Experiment. And the next sort of presentation for that is going to be Freedom Summit in Phoenix in February. And by then, I should have the design of the experiment finished. I should have the sort of ethical white paper I'm writing on the ethics of the experiment finished. And I'm hoping to have a sort of trailer finished, like a video presentation of the experiment and how it's going to be set up. And it'll be fake. It won't be with real subjects. It'll just be sort of actors going through the motions of the experiment to show how it will work. But that trailer will essentially be used as a sort of fundraising tool to raise the money to run the actual experiment.
I don't think I had heard of Freedom Summit. I'm Googling it now.
I think Ernest Hancock is one of the main organizers, and it takes place in Phoenix. I think it's annual. I don't know. I mean, I kind of came into the Liberty community through New Hampshire, so I've mostly been to New Hampshire events. And so this was the first year that I'd been to Libertopia, even though I live in California. And so this will be my first event in Phoenix, and so now I'm getting kind of plugged into the other events around the country.
Yeah, I'm looking at the site now. Phoenix is a really nice place to be in February.
Yeah, I'll bet.
It's much better. Hey, sorry to the folks in New Hampshire, but it's much better than being in New Hampshire in February.
Well, Liberty Forum is also in February, I think.
Yeah,
that's in New Hampshire.
Yeah, my wife and I were. Go ahead.
Liberty Forum is in a hotel, so you're not really exposed to the elements very much unless you go outside.
Yeah, my wife and I were up there for the 2013 Liberty Summit, and you just couldn't go outside. I mean, you know, we're from Ohio. We're used to ice cold winds coming down out of Canada. We're used to snow. We're used to all that stuff. And you just couldn't go outside. It was miserable weather the whole time we were up there. Well, we probably ought to wrap it up. Davi, I really appreciate you taking some time and talking to me. And
yeah, you know, I always am left with the feeling that I didn't finish talking about everything because I work on so much stuff. But that's okay. Yeah, you know, I love the show, Ben. I love coming on here and talking to you.
I appreciate that. And we'll be sure and get up some links so that folks can follow those over and maybe get themselves a t-shirt and get a hoodie at the same time and help out a homeless person while spreading the message of how great Bitcoins are. And you take care of yourself, Davi.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I'll talk to you later.
Yep, talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
And that was my conversation with Davi Barker yesterday. And thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.